Thank the organizers for, if I can remember to do that, inviting me here. I'm going to present some of the results that we've had in recent years when we have photons interacting with many atoms at once, and some of the fun things that can happen when you have that situation. And I'm going to pick from amongst the many different things some topics on superradiance, and as well as about atoms recoiling due to the photon momentum. So to remind people, there's quite a lot of mini-atom physics that happens when you have photons interact with light, and one of the interesting ones goes all the way back to basically the beginning of E&M, which is the Clausius-Mozatti correction to the susceptibility of gases, that the index of refraction isn't just proportional to the change in the index isn't proportional to the density, but there's corrections as the density goes up. And more recent than that, but still a long time ago, there's superradiance and subradiance, where having many atoms ends up giving you faster photon emission or slower photon emission than you would have expected, possibly. And in even more recent times, within the past decade or so, people have shown that you can have things like just a single layer of atoms, and if they're in a regular array that's with a spacing less than a wavelength or so, you can get 100% reflection of the photons from these things. And there's many, many other kinds of situations. So let's ease into this by thinking of a simple case where you have a single atom and it's in an excited state. And so you can imagine, for example, that you have something like an alkali in a stretched P state. It can only decay to the stretched S state when it goes down. So that might be like case A. You might have something a little bit more complicated, like say strontium in the say singlet P state, where it can decay into a singlet D state, as well as all the way back down to the S state. So that might be something like B, or you might be very highly excited and getting something, you know, many more possible ways of the photon emitting. But even though that's sort of complicated, that there's many possible photons coming out, the behavior is in some ways simple. It's that you just have exponential decay of the population with just a branching ratio into the different possible final channels. Now, if you have a whole bunch of atoms in a gas, and maybe they are somewhat close together so that they can talk to each other, one of the possible effects that comes about is superradiance. So there's, I just listed up here a couple of superradiance papers that has to do with Rydberg systems, which I'll talk about in a second. But first, let me just remind people what superradiance is. So when you have, say, a whole bunch of atoms that are excited and they're completely uncorrelated, when you start emitting photons, the effect of just emitting the photons themselves sets up correlations amongst the excited states in the atoms. And this can affect how fast photons come out. So the first photons will just come out with the number of excitations times the photo emission rate. But if you have something like that superradiance, what you'll find is that the rate of photon emission will increase with time. And if the system is really highly superradiant, what you'll find is that you'll get a peak of the photon emission rate that, instead of being proportional to the number of atoms, might be proportional to the number of atoms squared. So this is what superradiance is about in a simple case. So we, with my grad student Tyler, a few years ago, decided to think about modeling this. And so we went back and we said, let's go look at the simplest case where you have just one excited state can only decay to one final state, and revisit this. And the super radiance there is a little bit more complicated than the simple picture that I talked about, because what happens is if you start saying the atoms need to be closer than, say, a wavelength or so, there's not just decay into the vacuum. But once you've made a photon emission, you now have an atom that is in a different parity state than what you started. And now you can have atom-atom interactions. And this can cause dephasing. And so one of the interesting things that comes about of this is that you can kind of imagine if you say, all right, let's start out with, say, 160 atoms, and they're in a cloud this big. Well, they just emit photons randomly, just like any individual one would. But as you start shrinking the size of the cloud, they can start talking to each other through the photon emission, and you start getting super radiance. And as it gets smaller, because they're getting more and more atoms within a wavelength of each other, you get faster emission. But if you keep doing that, if you keep shrinking the size of that cloud, this atom-atom interaction starts doing bad things now, is that they'll have some that are really close, some that are farther away, and this gives you energy shifts, which causes dephasing, which tends to suppress the super radiance. And so one of the things that happens is that as you decrease the average spacing between the atoms, so this is plotting the scaled peak photoemission rate, so we take out the number of atoms, and we just take out gamma as well, is that as you make the average spacing between the atoms get smaller, the peak emission rate goes up and up and up, but if you make it too small, it starts coming back down. And so this is kind of fun to think about, because if you say, well, what happens if I'm something more complicated, like, say, a Rydberg atom, then you have this kind of situation just in spades, right? So if you have something like, say, a 26p state, so you put a whole bunch of 26p states in your system, and you say, well, let's think about how all the possible ways it can decay. Well, there's a whole bunch that you can decay to the 26s, the 25s, 24s, all the way down, right? And if you look at the dipole matrix elements, the rates that you go, there's a decent size to go to the 26s, a bit smaller to 25s, and then it gets small. But then by the time you get back to the ground state, it goes up again to a big number because of the big frequency beats the small dipole matrix element. And you can ask, well, what happens if I decide to look at super radiance for this kind of system? And one of the things that happens is if the density isn't so much, it behaves like you would expect in that the 26p prefers to decay to the 26s compared to the 25s. And if you look as a function of time, you find that there's proportionally more 26s happening. So you're speeding up the emission into the 26s as a function of time. So it's kind of super radiating into the 26s. But if you make it too small, a very interesting thing happens is that at very early times, the 26s starts beating the 25s again. But once you've made a few of them, they start dephasing, and it suppresses future 26s emissions. And what happens is you actually get a lot more 25s out than 26s. So super radiance inside of a Rydberg cloud is a somewhat interesting and complicated business between these things that are fighting each other. I guess we are supposed to.
One point.
I think later. Okay. So the thing that when you have a gas, you have all of these dephasings. And if you really want to see if you have interesting super radiance, you kind of have to follow the system for a decent amount of time. You need to see, am I getting a burst of photons coming out? And not just something that's kind of going to start getting faster and then fizzle. But if you're in an array, this was a very great insight by in this paper right here. If you're an array, dephasing isn't that much of an issue because all of the atoms are separated by about the same amount. And so all that you really need to ask is, am I emitting photons faster or slower as time increases? Right? So if I'm at t equals zero and I start emitting photons and I emit them more infrequently with time, then the photon rate is just dropping. It's not super radiant. But if the rate is increasing at early times, then you're going to be super radiant. And when they did the theory for this, they did it in terms of the G2. And since I don't work with G2s very much, I did it in a simpler way. As I just said, well, what's the slope of the photo emission rate? So what is the time derivative of the emission rate? And it turns out, weirdly enough, it's one of these accidents that the condition that they had for super radiance and what we derived is exactly the same. And so the interesting thing, though, about this is that if you try to model, say, 160 atoms that are two-state system that is super radiating, you need 2^160 states, and you immediately are forced to do severe approximations to try to model this. But if you're just asking, what's the slope of the photo emission rate at t equals zero? You can basically do it exactly for a huge number of atoms, because all that you're interested in is calculating the time derivative of this, and you can analytically find it in terms of the decay matrix. Now, one of the nice things that I liked about the way how we thought about this is that you can generalize this to the concept of super radiating into a particular direction. So if you just say, I just want to know how fast any photon is coming out, that's sort of a global super radiance question. But you might say, if I look in a certain direction, will I see an increasing photo emission rate as a function of time? And this is a question that you might be like, well, okay, that's kind of a little ticky-tacky kind of thing. But actually, there's an important thing about this, is that this rate, how this thing is happening at early time, so the photo emission rate has in it the average number of excitations, but it also has in it the correlations between pairs of excitations. And so if you want to say, what is the photo emission rate into a certain direction, it's proportional to this expression. And the first bit is just the average excitation. And the second is telling you about the correlations between pairs of excitations inside of the gas. So if you see something that's saying, OK, I have a faster emission rate into a certain direction, you're saying something about correlations that go with a particular Fourier component. Just to give an example, so for one line of atoms, this is the white spots on this graph are showing where you have super radiance, and the gray part is where you don't have super radiance. And so what we're looking at here is, as you have a perfect line of atoms equally spaced, just a single line, and as you increase the number of atoms, what happens is, because of dimensionality, after you get to about 10 or 20 atoms or so, not much else happens, because the atoms are getting sort of, the ends are getting so far apart, they don't really care about each other so much anymore. But an interesting thing happens is that there's sort of super radiance for a very small separation. So D is the separation between the atoms, which is what you would expect, right? You need to have them close to kind of super radiate. But there's this other kind of island of super radiance. If you have them separated just right, then as they emit photons, they can develop correlations which will cause them to super radiate in a particular direction. So that's, I think, an interesting effect from here. And just to see, like, another kind of cool thing, we did calculations for all kinds of ones, but here's one for where you have sort of pairs of atoms just in a line. So you have a huge line of atoms, but it's just a pair of them. And now you don't just get this extra little island right here. There's another set of correlations you can have, because now you have atoms that are kind of displaced into a second dimension, and you can get the interference to have super radiance at separations as big as the wavelength, which is kind of a surprising thing for such a system. Yes, the distance between the two lines is the same as the spacing. So you can just think of a square. Thanks, Tilma. So that's for a particular direction. And the other thing that you can do is, because you can actually solve this, you can do this for huge numbers of atoms, and you can just say whether I'm super radiating or not, just at all, just into all directions. And one of the interesting things about this is that if you're in 3D, as you make more and more atoms, so N1 is the number of atoms in one of the dimensions, as you make more and more atoms, you can have the atoms be further separated and still super radiate. And one of the things that the interesting things about this is, you can actually go through and find the initial asymptotic slope of this, and you can see that it's just going to be a constant plus a bit that depends on the wavelength squared over the distance between them squared times the number. So this is for 3D and for 2D. So this is telling you that if you have enough atoms, you will super radiate. I don't care how far apart you are for this thing. So this was all for just a pair of states, and I kind of got off topic for Rydberg's. But there is a bit here that I thought was really important. In the paper, I kind of didn't delve too far into it, but I would like to really stress it here, is that we could also look at, in essence, Rydberg states with this formalism. We could go in and see, like, well, what happens if I were to look at not just going all the way down to one state, but maybe I could go here, or, you know, a whole bunch of different states in between. And it turns out, when you do this, you go through the formalism, being a Rydberg state hurts for super radiance. And the reason is in some sense, you have so much competition with all of the different possible channels that you can go to. So if you have, like, one thing, like if you're going from some 60S state to, you know, the next below P state, if that wins by a lot, then you're golden. But that's not usually what happens when you're Rydberg state. You usually can go up to a whole bunch of different possibilities. And what happens is that this first term that's negative, that this is just coming from the average excitations in the atoms, instead of depending only on the total decay rate, it also depends on the branching ratio. So if you spread out your possible decays into a whole bunch of different possible states, it becomes hard to super radiate. You always can. So the number of terms in this second bit is proportional to the number of atoms squared. So eventually, this second term wins. But you need so many more atoms than you might have expected to get super radiance to happen for Rydberg atoms. All right. And one of the things, just as a side thing, I always, when I think of Rydberg atoms, I started with Rydberg atoms when, like, my computer, I felt like I needed to wind it up to make it work sometimes. I started out as like, okay, I don't need to worry about, like, fine structure splittings or hyperfine, none of that stuff. But if you think about, like, if I'm a, I don't know, 60p 3/2 state, just thinking about, like, all of the different possible states that you can decay to, it's enormous, right? So it's not just the d5 halves and the d3 halves and the s1 half, but it's the m's amongst those as well, right? So there's, even if you just say, I'm only thinking about the closest ones I could decay to, there's gobs of them. And so that will definitely hurt you if you're trying to think about super radiance for Rydbergs. before finishing with this topic, I just wanted to say everything that I was just talking about, imagine that the radiation field was at 0 Kelvin. If you are not at 0 Kelvin, there's a lot of black body photons around. And it turns out that those are like the biggest thing that's going in a lot of the situations. And people have thought about the collective photo absorption or photo stimulated emission from the black body photons. But I don't know that people have really thought about, okay, now is there correlations and am I getting something that's sort of the black body absorption version of super radiance? I don't know that anybody has done that, and even if that's a thing. But it's something to think about for this. So anyway, for this little part of the talk, I just wanted to say that when you're thinking about the photo emission rate and how super radiance in this mini atom system might behave, if you're talking about a lattice of atoms, you can probably just think about what's happening at early times. Am I increasing or not? And that's going to tell you a lot about whether you're going to have a decent amount of super radiance. But if you're in a gas, that's not maybe going to be super helpful. Now, one of the important things that Anna has emphasized is that dimensionality is important. So if you are trying to make, say, Rydberg arrays in 3D, you're really kind of packing them in there, as opposed to, say, a 2D array of atoms. So there's really a difference in how these systems behave if you end up having, say, a 2D array of atoms versus a 3D, because just of how many atoms are kind of close to each other and pack each other in. Okay, so now I would like to think about a different aspect of the photons and having momentum and easing into it with this paper that I did with Mark, who's here, and one of his students at the time, Trent. We're looking at how photon recoil and various aspects of having photons interact with atoms cause problems in different gates for involving Rydberg systems. And to give you, I'm not going to go into the details of this paper. I just, in some sense, using this to, everybody knows photons have momentum, but sometimes we forget. That I look at just one of the more straightforward of the concepts that we looked at. So we were looking at, for example, one of the cases is suppose you're doing some two-atom gate, and you do this thing where you do like a pi pulse to kind of turn a switch on one of the atoms. Then you're imagining that you're going to do a 2 pi kind of thing on the other atoms, and then you do a pi thing back on the first atom to get it back to the ground state. And of course, you're going, which I would never have thought of, but of course what happens is when you do the two different pi pulses, one comes from one way and the other comes from the other way, because you want to have it so that when you do, I mean, they come so that the kicks from the absorptions cancel each other out. You don't want to have the kicks in the same direction, right? So if I absorb, then I want to re-emit it to get rid of that. But one of the things that happens is there's a time difference between those two pi pulses. So imagine you're a blob of atom, so some wave function. You get a photon absorption and you get a momentum kick, and you start moving. And then you get your other kick, which stops the velocity, and you stop moving. But you're not the same wave function you were. And so in some sense, you've entangled the photon information with the internal information, and that causes a loss of fidelity. And one of the things that, of course, people do try to help out with having a loss of fidelity is you tend to go to atom traps that have high frequencies so that you're in a compact little system and things like little kicks won't do much to you. But the problem is if you're in a high frequency thing, your wave function is small in space. And so even little shifts start causing effects. And so there's a counterintuitive thing that happens here is that as you raise the frequency of the trap, instead of things getting better, things get worse. So just this is one of the things I'm more just kind of talking about this just to advertise it. I think that it's has a lot of nice effects in there that people should look at. So the last thing that I would like to talk about is going to be a bit off topic from Rydberg physics. And I was racking my brain to think, how can I tie it in? And I realized finally that it's not something that I can probably think of. Somebody else hopefully will be inspired by what I talk about here to realize that there's something interesting with Rydberg physics here. So what we were interested in starting a couple years ago is when you have all of these atoms that are close by to each other and they're maybe excited, maybe you're interacting with a laser. When I have a single atom and it emits a photon, I understand about the momentum kick that comes from that, right? It's just conservation of momentum. The photon goes out with a certain momentum. The atom has to recoil in the opposite direction. It's a simple thing. But what happens if I have a whole pile of atoms? And they have one excitation. Is it that, in some sense, one atom gets all of the kick, but with a probability given by, I don't know, like the weight of the excitation that it had? Or is the kick spread out amongst all of the atoms? And that's a huge difference, right? Because if one atom gets all of the kick, it also gets all of the recoil energy. But if you share the momentum amongst the atoms, then the recoil will be substantially smaller, right? Depending on how many you do, right? So if I share the kick amongst two atoms, if each one gets a half, then they each get a quarter of a recoil energy, not a half. So this was kind of an interesting question to me, is if you have these atoms that are sort of close by to each other, how do they share in the momentum kick from the photons? So you can think of, say, so I have here just like a simple thing, like imagine you have three atoms, they're all in the ground state, a photon comes in, it's absorbed, but the excitation could be on any of the atoms and you have a superposition of these. And the recoil will go, in some sense, maybe with the excitation, maybe not. And then you emit the photon, and then you have recoil amongst the different atoms. So this is kind of the picture. It's a very simplistic picture. And you can also imagine, in some sense, not even doing this step. Like, I can say, all right, you know what? I'm just going to, because I'm a theorist, I can just put the damn excitation wherever I want and then just solve for what the wave function does and see what happens. So we decided to look at that. And I'm just going to say a little bit about the calculations because it's not super important. You can look at the paper for details. But we really tried to do the excitation part right. It's a density matrix treatment. Then you say, all right, but you've done that. Shouldn't you do a good job on the center of mass motion? And so we did that too. So we really are trying to do the full density matrix treatment of how both the center of mass motion and the excitations behave in the system. Now, if you do that, you're like, in your brain, you should be shouting bullshit right now. Because there's no way you can do that. There's not enough computational power for this. But one of the things that we can do, so we started out with, is we could say, look, usually the time scale for photons' absorptions and emissions is sub-microseconds. Whereas typical trap frequencies are, I don't know, 10, 100 kilohertz, that's so much slower. So you can do, in essence, when you go through it, you can say, I can do something that's like an impulse approximation, and it will be fantastic. And so we have done some tricks to do a treatment that we think is as good as doing it exactly. So to give you an idea of what happens here is we started out with two atoms. And we started out with a symmetrical wave function, a GE plus an EG. So the excitation is equally likely to be on either atom, and we did a symmetric wave function. And we started with that at t equals zero with the atoms stationary, and you just let the wave function evolve, and the photon is emitted, and they both end up in the ground state, and there's a kick. And you can look at, for example, the recoil momentum. And if you're like me, you have to do it experimentally. And I have the two atoms, say, on the z-axis. And I'm like, why aren't we getting recoil in the x-y direction? That took like a day to figure out. But it's because the emission in the x-y is symmetric. So the average momentum kick in x and y is zero. You only get a kick, momentum kick along the axis. And it's not very big. It's very small, and it's like a tenth of the kick that you would expect. So you're like, oh, okay, so what's going on there is like, okay, there's a kick, but it's in like some weird direction. It averages to zero. And this direction, you're not getting sort of a momentum kick. You're getting like forces, right? Because it's a dipole-dipole interaction between atoms. There's some kind of force that's pushing these things. So you're getting that. So if you look at the recoil energy, that's okay, because if you can't average to zero, right? It's like a px squared that you're averaging over. So that you do see that there's a recoil energy, and it's not just one recoil energy. It differs depending on the separation. There are some distances, like this distance right here, if you just look at the red and the yellow one, where you get more recoil energy than one photon really should have been able to give. And there's some distances where you get less. So that was kind of a head scratcher a little bit. So it's like, okay, well, that's cool. We definitely checked everything. That's fine. Everything works. What we decided is like, okay, that's hard to understand, so let's do this thing where we make an atom array, and if you make the separation between the atoms less than a wavelength, you can get 100% reflection. And so we sent a beam of photons at this atom array, and let's look at the right side first. And we said, what kind of momentum kick will I get in the direction the photon is traveling as a function of the detuning? And you get something that looks like a Lorentzian. And when you go through it, you find that it's exactly equal to the probability for reflecting a photon times twice the recoil momentum, which is what you would expect, right? A photon bounces back, you get two, right? So that was cool. We was like, we finally understand something about this. But if you go and look at the recoil energy, what I was expecting was the recoil energy to be 4 at the maximum or less, because I'm shearing. It's more. You get more. So this was even more puzzling. Okay, so finally I had a very good grad student, Deepak, came in, and he went through And he's like, okay, let's just look at an 8x8 array. We can put the excitation on the array in an excitation eigenstate. So because of the atom-atom interactions through the radiation field, there's excitation eigenstates. And you can make an excitation eigenstate that will decay fast or an excitation eigenstate that decays slowly. And you say, how much energy do I get as a function of that? And one of the interesting things that he found is if you look perpendicular to the array, you get that the amount of recoil energy deposited into the array is exactly proportional to the lifetime of the state. And the factor is 2/5. If you look in the array, you don't see that. You see something roughly like that, but it's not exact. Say again? Yeah. So you see something kind of like that, but it's not so great. And if you think to yourself, it's like, okay, but as theorists, we can put these things on a perfect plane. In some sense, there's no forces that can come from the dipole-dipole interaction out of the plane, but only in the plane. So there's maybe some kind of thing that this is a pure damping kind of effect when I'm perpendicular, and this has some forces in it that's giving you something that's weird. But the most interesting thing about this is that, for example, you can do something like a little cavity of these things. You can make, like, instead of two arrays, and curve them a little bit to make a cavity where the photons can't decay, you know, basically at all. And you can make really, really long lifetime states. You can make states, so for this 11 by 11 array, you can make a state whose lifetime is basically 10 to the 4 of a one atom lifetime. And you can ask, what happens then? How much recoil energy is deposited in the array? And it's 10 to the 4. One photon gave you 10 to the 4 recoils. And it turns out some of it is simple. It's like, well, which recoils the most? It's the center one, because that's, in some sense, where the atoms are interacting the most. You get almost 1,000 recoils for the center atom. But you should be a little bit worried, because I said we were doing this impulse approximation where we were assuming the decay happened fast, and now it's happening slow. But the thing that how Deepak is, he went and did this, taking away the impulse approximation, and you can find that there are some differences, but for this perpendicular direction, it's perfect. So this is, I think, an interesting thing, and this is my last slide, is that if you have subradiant states, you can get so much more recoil than you might have expected. And this is maybe something that's of concern, because when people talk about, well, let's make these excitations on atoms and we'll put it in such a way that it doesn't radiate, you're like, okay, that's cool. There are repercussions, right? Because this thing is in some sense really trying to emit a photon and is really getting a lot of recoil energy in that process. The last thing that I would like to think about for the future is a lot of these things we did just imagining sort of weak lasers is how to go beyond this weak laser limit. We're thinking about that. We have some ideas, but let me stop here. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for this inspiring talk. Are there questions, I'm sure? Mark, over there. No, but it's for the online people. You need to talk to.
Francis, you emphasized that even for very dilute samples, if you have enough atoms, you can get superradiance. Does the same argument apply for subradiance? That's also possible in arbitrarily dilute samples? I would think so.
I've never thought about it. I mean, my initial answer is like my brain is screaming yes, but I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question. I think the answer is yes.
Any other question?
Thank you for your okay.
Go ahead.
Oh.
Talking.
Should I?
Go ahead.
Okay. Regarding your problem that you raised here about the when you have read back atoms, at a certain point you have so many levels. Is it possible to consider a model where you have some continuous diffusive model for the excitation that you could couple to your equations and consider as a Fokker-Planck term? Let's say that you could add to your.
That's a good. Yeah, I. There's so other people have done models for these things and approximations. So Suzanne Yellen has also done a lot of work on super radiants for these things, and I how they talk about it is similar to what you're saying. So it might be that it's already been done. But what you said sounds plausible. We can talk about it after.
I think my questions actually might be related. Speaking about the multiple decay rate or decay paths for a super radiant Rydberg ensemble, do you think it would be possible to add a cavity to that system to preferentially super radiate into a particular mode, limit the other decay paths?
Yeah.
And if you could, what kind of finesse do you think it would take to sort of suppress those deleterious paths relative to like a ground state system?
I think that's definitely a thing, right? Because you're in essence manipulating the density of states, and by raising that density of states, you're in some sense say maybe pulling one out of the pack and making it, you know, really special. So I'm fairly certain that would work. And I don't think that you would have to work super hard at it. Like I think that if you could, for some of them, just raise the density of states by a bit more than, say, like a factor of 10 to 100, you'd probably be able to make one of them win big. And probably somebody's even done it, I would guess. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But you said that being a Rydberg state for super radiance hurts, but maybe would that be more that being a low L Rydberg state? Because you could be in a circular state, and then you've only got one decay pathway.
That's right.
And then maybe you
yes.
can really have a strong effect. Yeah?
Yes. Circular states. Okay. I was always thinking of the low L states. Dang. Yeah. Now you only have one possibility again. Yeah. I'm just trying to think. Is there a downside? I don't think there is. I think you're right. I think that you could then just think of this as a two-state system. I mean, there's the issue that state itself can radiate down.
Yeah.
But for super radiance, usually you kind of build up a head of steam. And so by the time that one starts saying, I can radiate myself, you're probably on the downward slope. So I think.
But can you get do you then get a cascade of super radiance like down the chain? Maybe it gets a bit complicated.
Oh, could you?
Maybe the connection I'm trying to think is with the anti-hydrogen experiments. I mean, you've done calculations, yeah, that like you start to decay from the circular states or things like circular states, but maybe does that speed up by super radiance of the super radiance? I'm that's kind of what I was wondering.
I haven't thought of it. That's a great question. I'll write that down.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you for the inspiring talk, as you said. I'm still puzzled by your statement about the recoil energy versus the recoil momentum in this collective system. You said that you can have more than the expected recoil energy for a given recoil momentum. Now, if I think about the Mössbauer effect, yeah, I understand that you can have less because you have a huge mass, because the atoms are interacting and they make an object that effectively has a larger right. mass. But if you say it becomes larger, then the mass has to be reduced. And so how can you understand that? Or is it that you are measuring the energy in a certain frame that you don't take into account, let's say, the repulsive interaction between the
there's a couple things. So in that first one where you just had the two atoms, I was just looking at the expectation value of the momentum after, which always, so if I did some kind of correlated thing, say, okay, the photon came out in this direction, what was your momentum? Mm-hmm. Then I would have gotten, I think, the full PR, okay. right? But this is different, where you have, as the lifetime goes up, you get more recoil energy out. And how I think of it, so I think there, I think of it two ways, one which I hate, and one which I'm, but I think can I explain easily, and one which I like, but is hard. So one way that I think about it is that if I'm subradiant, in some sense what I'm doing is I'm emitting a photon and absorbing it, emitting it, absorbing, emitting it, absorbing. And in the case of a cavity, you can even just picture the damn photon going back and forth. And that's why it kind of gives you so much energy, is because it bounced so many times, right? But the thing is even when you can't picture it bouncing, you get this increase. And how I'm thinking of it is this kind of thing where the photon kind of goes out and you kind of recoil, and then it's maybe absorbed by another one and it recoils and it goes back out. So that's why I think it's going up linearly. So that's the explanation I hate. The explanation that I like is that what you've done is you've coupled the atoms to this other thing, right? The actual Hamiltonian is more complicated than these things, and you've coupled it. You can think about it as like, okay, suppose I have this system and I couple it to some harmonic oscillator thing. Well, now when I have them evolve together, this harmonic oscillator thing is going to cause this thing to do something. And that's the one that I can't really explain, but in my head is beautiful. So I think that's why this is happening. So to me, this was a huge surprise. I mean, we spent like a month trying to make this go away. That as the lifetime of the state went up, the recoil energy went up.
Francis, couldn't you look at something like absorption depth? Like an effective absorption depth to see which interpretation is right?
But this is, so this would be like, I have 121 atoms in a plane, right? Just 11 by 11 array. I'm not quite sure how to picture absorption depth for that. But you can make a very subradiant state, like, and then you can kind of imagine like the photon is like popping off on one part of the array and coming back in on another part, and you know it's trying to escape, but it's subradiant and it can't.
Isn't there like some connection to like absorption depth or like index of refraction or something like that you could think about?
I haven't yet, so all I can say is I'm not sure. It sounds like it could be plausible.
Is there any other question? If not, we close the session remarking that the Spanish chair... Yep.